decide on that spontaneously. And with that, let's start with the talk. We're looking forward to Teresa and Lisa Moore. They both are social scientists in the Center for Social Innovation in Vienna. And the title of the talk is Gender Equality in Making. And I'm really looking forward to it. Hi. Welcome to our session. We will talk about gender equality and making. We'd like to introduce ourselves. I'm Teresa Schäfer and I'm Lisa Moore-Seebacher. We are both working at the Center for Social Innovation in Vienna. I'll just start with the slides. So what is this about? Our work we want to present and discuss with you was realized in the course of the project Critical Making. It's about how responsible making can contribute to better innovation that responds to the needs of society. That all sounds really abstract, but we picked three concrete cases we'll have a closer look at. So the first one is inclusivity. How can I make making accessible and open for every gender? The second field would be young makers of every gender, how to make it accessible for them. And the third one is about open hardware and the use of hardware. So the first field we will talk about in our talk is this gender equal making. And in this field, we worked together with 12 makers from our community. They have different backgrounds coming from different regions and countries. And we tried to develop formats to make making more gender inclusive. From this co-designing process, there emerged three fields of action. The first field is about making accessible for caretakers or legal guardians. So when people become guardians of their children, they often drop out of the making process. So how can we make it accessible in a way that children and parents can collaborate there? How can we improve the process? The second field is about gender responsibility, to make people more aware of it, to point out gender diversity and that it's needed in making. And the third field is about supporting women in local communities to find their way to making. So both of these fields come from an African context, from South Sudan and Cameroon, from women whom we collaborated with there. You will find information about all of these topics on our website. You can find the link on the right side of this slide. But for now, we want to focus on the two highlighted areas to create more awareness for gender diversity in making. So let's continue with our idea of inspirational stories. How did we come to this idea? So the initiative was created by an Indian colleague named Audrey Sousa. The idea was to make making approachable for different genders and attractive. In the course of that, we have to answer the question, what does it have to do with me? Do I feel comfortable there? Is it something for me? What can I achieve or do in this process of making it? It's all about creating role models and to see, have a look at how those people did this. And with this goal in mind, to create role models, we collected several stories of different people who are makers. We want to make those stories visible and accessible. So we interviewed those people. We interviewed 13 people from different parts of the world. And questions we asked was, how did you get to making? What did support you on your way? And what difficulties or barriers did you encounter? And in the aftermath, what would be your message to your younger self? And then on this next slide, we can see the diversity of those people we were in touch with. And they told us they are very enriching and very different stories. Stories from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Europe. And depending on the context, also the difficulties they encountered were very different. And they also told us what helped them on their way. You can read all of those stories on the website. Again, we shared the link below. It's about understanding how diverse making can be.
Okay, and now for the next part that we wanted to present, in addition to all of these inspiring stories, we also worked on some guidelines that I want to present to you. There was this idea made by Sin, which focuses on two big areas. One of it is making recommendations for how makerspaces can work more inclusively. And these are like little points where hackerspaces can reflect on to become more inclusive. And then there are the guidelines, the introductions into how inclusive making can look and what we actually mean with diversity and intersectionality and what that all that has to do with making and embedding that whole topic in an explanation. To be read by people. There are some links already in this slide and for these two pieces of info. And what's very important is that we create these solutions with the entire community, and we have discussed them and expanded them with the entire community. But they are not complete yet. They are. That can be added, and we are very interested in, and we want to focus on the fact that this is a living document and can be expanded. Lots of things are still open, and we are available for discussions, which we will also mention later. And we are excited if these guidelines can be expanded further. And in order to still present what the current state of these documents is, I still want to present them. One important point in these guidelines for makerspaces is that to be more inviting within a makerspace. What has proven very helpful here is that makerspaces should arrange together with the community and create a code of conduct together. How do we want to handle difficult situations within the team, the space? In order to make it easier for other people that to have procedures if anything occurs. If something doesn't work for one person, then it's not just in the responsibility of that one person, but it's more of an issue of how the entire community wants to handle this and how can we support them. The other thing that also proved helpful was to have a awareness team. People that are available to talk to when issues occur. Ideally two persons, so one person can take a break. Also, in language, there's a very big difference in how inviting a makerspace can be. What languages are available? Are there translation systems and other opportunities for people to actually participate and being able to take part in the offers provided? And then finally, being available for feedback and other perspectives. If new people come into the makerspace and bring their new experiences and make new experiences, to be available for integrating those experiences and integrating them and letting them happen. That can be something that can bring very positive change. Another point would be how can we reach new members? What groups are already present in a makerspace, and why do we have these groups? Why maybe do we not have other groups within here? And how this covers the diversity aspect a lot. And how can we reach new communities and social groups? There are lots of initiatives and organizations that work with these groups and can be very helpful. Also, with internal events, maybe, can there be some formats or events for new members? And also creating structures where new members can integrate with their own projects and take part in them. Giving them a guideline to be able to participate better. Mentoring can be also a very helpful system here to make these people feel more invited. And lastly, we also want to talk about rooms and barriers and the structures. What physical barriers maybe exist within the makerspace? Are we communicating well about these barriers? Barriers to maybe some people being available. Also financial barriers, of course. Are there maybe discounts for memberships or the possibility to use it for free? Maybe for people that have limited financial possibilities. What does the situation look like with materials and tools? How can they be made available? Is this maybe excluding some people, or can this be made available to less privileged people? Okay. And last but not least, actually the timing of events can be making a very big difference. When workshops are held, for example, can affect a lot what people can take part in them. Is this a time where some people that have to take care of other people have to bring them to bed? Or and maybe can they never be available for these times? It's worth a thought to think about what kinds of people maybe would have time during different times, and maybe thinking about alternating timetables for events to make this more available. As we said, these guidelines are not entirely done yet. And there are probably lots of tips that can be included. And I also shortened this down a lot on our website. There are a bunch more information about this and also explanations. We would welcome it if you have recommendations and comments on things we mentioned that are written there, things that we could include that we can then reflect on. We want to thank you for listening, and we are excited for the Q&A that will be following.
Super, vielen, vielen herzlichen Dank.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to Theresa and Lisa Mo. Well, I have to point out that I hear myself. But anyway, thanks for the talk, and I'm looking forward to many questions from the audience. please send them directly for us to collect them or IRC with the hashtag Firefox Fireshanks 22 or on Mastodon or Twitter with the hashtag Fireshanks. And I hope they will arrive soon. And Lisa Mo is here now to answer all of your questions. Let's see if some questions have arrived already. Oh, I can directly jump in with one of my questions. Nice. So thanks very much for the talk. And first of all, I will have a question that immediately jumped to my mind. So you talked to 12 people. How did you get that idea?
All right. So one of the basic ideas of that story was to ask people that had a potential for identification, maybe people that not people that everybody knows already, where this is not maybe not really interesting to people looking at it, that maybe already know these people or don't want to know them, but maybe people that are more interesting to learn about because they are not very well known yet. And that's we actually worked a lot with the project partner Greek there, this innovation gathering system, which is a global network of makers around the world. And with this network, we were able to actually get more recommendations for what kinds of people we could ask, and that's how we collected and found these 12 people. And of course, we tried to interview more people. Not everybody answered, of course. There are also some more stories that will likely be added. But basically, the stories that we have are quite good spread about how diverse these stories can be and what the socially cultural construct context around these people and maybe the barriers they had and the goals they had was, and what that looked like.
Well, that's a whole bundle of stories. I think it's a really beautiful idea. And now the first questions are flying in. The first one is about the code of conduct. Why do you think this is a case of conflict? And why would it be helpful for all people involved? But why is there even conflict involved?
All right, so we tried presenting a code of conduct as a positive example of how to deal with conflicts and framing it in this positive context. We don't think that code of conducts can create cases of conflict, but they can be used for conflict cases and provide a very helpful base for handling these conflict cases. And they provide this context where you don't have to create the structures for dealing with a conflict, but you can deal it within the context of this predefined system. I think code of conducts are very important. And I think there also was a session about this already.
How do you understand the creation of a code of conduct? Is it like a very long process or a very open and accessible process where many topics are brought up people are not aware of? How do you approach it?
Okay, this is also a very important question. Even though I personally wasn't involved in any such process yet, but I can maybe tell of some experiences that people told us in the interviews. This sometimes was a very difficult process that had to be inquired about by individual people after there were incidents and where maybe some individual people had to take a decision and had to ask for this support. And in one space, maybe there was this was a bigger issue where it went through multiple circles. And only then people actually thought about what steps have to be taken in order to ensure that this wouldn't happen again like this. And the leaders of that makerspace actually changed a lot throughout this case and got more into the diversity topic and engaging with that. And this entire thing positively changed the environment there. I think a code of conduct can very much bring a more positive perspective. Of course, it's a very long and boring process, maybe, but it's good for the entire community if it's done.
Do you have any tips on how to approach this topic? I heard that during the co-designing process, you started with the strings attached to it. Is it also an approach to develop a code of conduct? Maybe you could tell us what co-design is for you and if it can be of help when drafting a code of conduct.
Yeah, okay, so our co-design process was created in a way that right from the start we had a very open idea of mainly us wanting to work on this topic, but we wanted to keep it as open in such a way that each individual ideas and approaches could be brought to the table. And so when you start with a code of conduct, you probably need this openness so that the things that are created from it aren't predefined by some individual people. But maybe the idea should be we should have a code of conduct, but no predefined notions of what needs to be in there and how often it can be edited. And these are all things that have to be edited iteratively. And another thing that's very important in the co-design process is to always think about whether all the people that are participating and what perspective are they coming from, and can they all actually be involved in the creation process. There are often some people that maybe are quite extroverted in these sorts of situations and are very used to telling their own opinion and participating, and then there are people that are maybe more held back. And that's why we also used different contexts of individual groups in the creation process. There are these smaller groups that are always assembled in a different way that this allows people to take on different roles in their individual groups in various points. So they can all share and participate with their own opinions and experiences. And so we also have various methods there. This in our case was an online workshop because the participants came from different countries, and so we had different slots, one in pre-noon and one later. Then there are lots of people came from the American context, and then because maybe Indonesian people and people from Latin America had a difficult time coming together, we tried to give lots of different opportunities and digital methods where people could post virtual post-its and take notes as if they were working in the same room. This is of course also something that can be integrated into this kind of co-design process, and actually you can use these kinds of co-design systems to create a code of conduct, but there can also be other things.
Well, that's a very cool approach. If you have different people, you choose different formats, because some people would be more prone to participate in other formats. To continue with this, how did you deal with the question of time privilege in order to participate in such a process, which is time intensive? Sometimes it's always the same people because they have time anyway. So did you talk to the participants to see if they can participate, or how did you do that?
All right. So it very much depends. We tried inviting people at sometimes actually just didn't have any time to participate at all. We made 3 workshop sessions within this co-design process. And not all people were available to take part in all 3 sessions for various reasons. Maybe people got sick or their child got sick. All of the usual reasons. And at the same time, we very clearly mentioned, which is very important in the work with various communities, what do the participants of the workshop get from participating? What can we give to them as a project? And because we want that the people that bring ideas to the table and work with us, that we want them to also be able to get something from this. And that's why we also thought a lot about the fact that for the participation in these 3 workshops, all of the participants were supposed to get not quite an hourly rate, but a participation payment. Because of course they had to use their internet bandwidth, which is not maybe the easiest thing in some countries, where some people had to maybe buy additional data volume. And at the same time, this also enabled these people to participate with other people that they didn't know yet, that and things that were maybe important to these participants, and talk about them and actually bring their issues to the table. And we were able to provide the budget of the project by taking this project along and providing them just with the things they need to actually participate.
Well, that's exciting. So you get new creations, new ideas.
Yes.
So I think we're shortly cut off in our stream during the first question you answered. So now I really have to think, what was the first question I asked you? Well, maybe could you tell us again, how can one participate or comment or give feedback, because there might be many other stories out there. Are you still searching for those? What are the options?
Ah, yeah, okay. So there's definitely the possibility to comment on the guidelines that I mentioned on the video. And for this, we have our project website, which is called Critical Making. CriticalMakingAltogether.eu, which is also listed on our slides. And on that page, you can find all of the information. There are these guidelines and the recommendations for how to make makerspaces more inclusive. And we have left the commenting function open on these documents, and you can directly go there and give us all of your comments and ideas, critique, and all of the things. We have to moderate these things, of course. Nothing will immediately appear online, nothing that we haven't scanned, but yeah, so this commenting section can be used freely. And also you can contact Teresa and me directly. Our email addresses are on the Q&A slide. And we are also excited if anyone wants to give us one of their inspirational stories. Then we are also excited about that. Maybe people that want to tell about themselves, or maybe people that know people that have taken a very interesting path into the space, but that maybe people would want to read. We are very open for recommendations there. And also, if those guidelines are shared with other groups, if people that are looking at this and think they want to share it for further feedback, then we would also be very excited about that.
Okay, cool. Thanks. And in the meantime, I remembered the first question when the stream dropped. So it was the question for the code of conduct and why is it seen as a conflict? What are your experiences in drafting it?
I think the first question was whether this can be associated with conflicts, and I said that I hope I haven't presented it like this. I think that a code of conduct is not generally a negative thing, but in our experiences it is something very positive. It's a support net that people can use in the case of a conflict. And this is something that is a structured system that can be used to deal with conflicts. And it's a very important base to have that can be very difficult and to create, where lots of different points of views will collide there. And this can create a lot of questions within a community that have to be discussed all the way.
So that means a code of conduct is really important. What's your approach to really living it? Is it maybe too general sometimes or too specific? So what's the actual use case of a code of conduct?
Well, I think this is hard to generalize for all makerspaces, because all of them have, of course, different communication cultures, maybe. And this can be very difficult. It, of course, is supposed to match the space, and it should be open for changes that may come later, both from the community itself that uses the space, but also for maybe new situations that might occur. And I think a code of conduct needs to stay open, and maybe also it needs to be looked at in regular intervals to see if changes are needed. And at the same time, I also think that there should be a compromise to be found between laying down the ground rules and the more broader things, maybe things about homophobia and transphobia. And this can provide the space of rules. That is something that maybe is very helpful and doesn't need to expand it a lot. And then there are lots of different areas of application, from maybe interactions or conflicts with people from other spaces that people can use to grow from, to learn from. And this is something where you can probably also discuss with other spaces together and get some inspiring content from.
Yeah, and a code of conduct is also always attached to how it's being acted out if there are incidents.
Yes, of course. A code of conduct that is only on the wall and not looked at, and maybe says never assume malice, that may be meant very well, but it's often not very helpful, because even if a person meant something well, that often is not sufficient for everyone. It has to have some applicability. It needs to be actually used to be useful.
It's a continuous communication process between how do you mean it and how it is actually received. I think a lived code of conduct is something different than just creating one. But I always asked me if you have to get back to it frequently. Are there spaces who do that? That they get back to it? How do they do it?
Yeah, this is also a question that I can only answer with maybe an example here, because based on the experiences that spaces shared with us. So there are spaces that, well, it very much depends on the structural change within the space. Maybe the leadership changes, and then the code of conduct is looked again anew and looked once over whether it still fits. And maybe there are some internal reflection processes, maybe something happened, some incident, and then people are looking at the code of conduct again and looked at as a base of the work together, and maybe some rules have to be reconsidered. Then at the same time, some people that in some spaces that have this process and actually take their time with this process and look at it a lot. There's also a big difference in whether this is happening top-down or bottom-up. There are probably maker spaces that have one code of conduct that they enforce for all areas of the space that maybe lots of participants and members haven't even looked at. It's a very different thing than when all members are included in the creation and have actually worked on it. And of course, when these things are done anew and looked over is, of course, something that also depends on the space culture.
Yeah, well, it always have to suit the people who are in the space or who want to join the space. So thank you very much for the talk. And